My name is Jackie Brolsma, and I have been serving the village this week as the philosopher. And that is a nebulous sort of description of an activity that I'm still trying to figure out, and maybe I will by tomorrow when I leave. But one of the things that happens at Holden through the summer is that we have an opportunity at least once, maybe twice, maybe three times a week to come together in a forum like this. And it has a long history of being a time when a lot of the conversation that has come out of the sessions that continue and are kind of controversy and hot have more time in a setting like this to kind of be discussed and kind of debated back and forth in a spirit of love and grace and fun and with a lot of lively input from everyone. And the ground rules are basically the same for any kind of good discussion. We ask no one person to dominate and to respect their opinions, and actually we really encourage them and hope that we can have some meaningful conversation around the topic. And sometimes that's hard at Holden because it seems like we all can agree on so many things. It's hard sometimes to come up with, you know, controversy, but I think we all like to have lively discussions, so we hope that all happens tonight. What we usually do is have a few people make some comments on it, and I have to, for the sake of the tape, give the title, which is Compromise Not Just for Wimps. We always try to have something kind of clever to get you here, but the weather helped out tonight, so we're glad you're here. But it's kind of asking the question of whether or not we've lost the art of positive compromise in an age of sort of in-your-face confrontation and inability for sometimes, especially in the political arena, we've seen a paralyzation and certainly a polarization and a not inability to sort of move forward. And we see it happening in other settings as well, in religion and education and so forth. So we usually feature a few people to make some comments on it, and then we open it up for discussion and try to be respectful of everyone's time and ideas. So with that, we'll go ahead and start. And I really give credit to Gary, who's going to start with the sort of coming up with the topic. He sort of jumped off the bus and approached me right away saying he wanted to talk about this. So it also kind of bubbled up throughout the week in some of, especially John's sessions and some of Mary's sessions as well. So Gary will start out and we'll hear from everyone else. I just ask you to introduce yourselves and so everyone knows who you are.
Well, I'm Gary Kubley. I am an ELCA pastor who also happens to be a member of the Minnesota Senate. I saw Elsa Marty come in. I am John Marty's seatmate on the Senate floor. And so, you know, I haven't seen you for a decade, Elsa. I still know who you are. But, you know, I guess a number of years ago, this is my eighth year in the Minnesota legislature. You know, I'm going to give you just a thumbnail sketch of my background. I guess, you know, my predecessor in the legislature called me and told me that he was going to quit on 2 days hence, and would I be willing to announce that I was going to run in his place at the same time. Now, it was Tuesday in Holy Week, for those of you who and I had a funeral on Thursday, as well as extra services, and one the day after Easter as well. I told him I couldn't possibly make a decision like that at that time, but over the span of the next couple of weeks, was it, I got, I don't know, but we lost count, 35 or 40 calls asking me if I would be willing to run for this seat. And, you know, I finally told my spouse, who's here also, that you know, I kind of felt like maybe I ought to run, and she said she thought I should too. And so, you know, here I am. I'm not sure if that qualifies as being summoned out. you know how it is. You know, Lutherans like a little melancholy, and if you get in a religious setting, so much the better. You know? But anyway, that's kind of how I became involved in elective office. You know, by the encouragement of friends and neighbors to pursue that spot. I guess the concern that I had and that I brought to Jackie is that it does seem to me that, you know, the political arena in state and in federal politics, I think, has become more and more polarized every year that I've been there. And certainly every election that I have run for re-election. My question to Jackie is, how do we get back to a point of compromise? How do we reclaim the art of compromise? And so that's the question that I would like you to entertain in your mind as you listen to us give a few comments. Most of the comments that I'm going to make are based on a book called Republic on Trial by Alan Rosenthal and three colleagues of his. I think he does a good job of looking at what a representative democracy is about. He looks at a couple of alternatives. The alternatives that he offers remind me of something that Winston Churchill said a number of years ago when he said, democracy is the worst form of government that you can possibly have, except for all the others that have been tried. In other words, he's saying there really isn't a real, clean and smooth running form of government out there. My perception is, and having looked at some of the alternatives, that a representative democracy is probably the best that there is. But how do we reclaim this whole business of compromise when Jackie writes on the board that it's not for wimps? There's a sense today in which compromise is seen in the same category as a four-letter word. It's seen as a dirty word. Some people believe that if you're willing to compromise, you are selling out on your principles. And yet it seems to me that the legislative process functions best if there is compromise. And it also centers around this whole business of conflict in the legislative arena. It seems, and Rosenthal says in his book, that the American public tends to support a democracy in the abstract, but they're just not real crazy about seeing it in action. And I think, when you look at it, people don't like conflict. And probably that's one of the good reasons not to have a direct form of democracy, where everybody votes on every issue. And we do have, this initiative and referendum proposal that has gained status in some states where people vote on a wide variety of issues. And yet, the state of Oregon, in the last election, had a book about this size, a little bit larger than this. For those of you who live in small towns, about the size of your phone book, which is a little bit higher and a little bit wider than this, but about this thick. And you were supposed to read up on 200 and some initiatives that you could then vote on. Well, about 59% of the people voted in that election, and less than one-third of them voted on the initiatives. So you've got less than 20% of the people deciding what then becomes law. It does seem to me that, encountering the difficulty to kind of bring yourself up to speed to vote on issues in an informed way, it seems to me that we're asking the public to do a job that representative democracy has done fairly well over the years. And so should we abandon a representative democracy in favor of some other kind because we perceive that it's politics as usual? Rosenthal says that politics as usual is the way democracy works. And so, we need to consider that. I think, we mean something quite negative when we say politics as usual. Rosenthal sees that in a much more positive light. But I think, I do think that we see it as a selling out on our principles, at least in some circles. Now, I think this whole business of a lack of compromise that state legislatures and even the federal Congress has experienced of late is a refusal to compromise. But some folks, couch their opposition to compromise in terms that say they're trying to eliminate conflict from the process. And I think there's a sense in which the public sees both conflict and compromise as being innately evil, and so they would like to eliminate them at all costs. But yet, you know, it seems to me that, you know, every once in a while somebody asks me what I think of the legislature. And my response is, the legislature is organized conflict. And I usually get laughter when I say that, but I'm not trying to be funny. You know, I'm just stating what I see as the reality. I mean, and even the special interest groups. I mean, look at the society in which we live. There are a lot of special interest groups. There, you know, you've got education, you've got law enforcement. I mean, there are just a myriad of special interests out there. You know, and I've heard it said that, you know, legislatures don't function very well because they're just promoting their own interests and they aren't listening to the people, and that's why there's all this conflict. I would agree with Rosenthal, who says that there is conflict, not because legislators are not listening to the people they represent, but because they are. We are representatives of the people that we represent, and they don't all think alike. Surprise, surprise. So, yeah, well, Jackie told me that she was going to sit here and touch me on the arm because it wouldn't look very good if she tried to slap her hand over my mouth. She's telling me it's time to be quiet already, you know, so, just to come back, I guess, I'd like to raise the issue again about, you know, how do we get back to that art of compromise? You know, is it going to take, you know, a revolution at the ballot box in order to move back to a point where, I mean, you know, that's the way legislatures have always functioned. You know, I'll just make that final comment. You know, diverse opinions are expressed, and, you know, sometimes selfish opinions are even expressed. But every legislator has to be willing to compromise, even on their most cherished piece of legislation, in order to move the process forward. In the end, you'll probably only get a portion of what you want. In my opinion, a portion of what you want is better than nothing. And your constituencies who supported that legislation will still probably grumble a little bit by saying, well, you know, we only got half a loaf and we're right and they're not, and, you know, we deserve to get the whole loaf. But the reality is, you know, like Henry Kissinger said, you know, a number of years ago, you know, he said, the best point that you can probably ever reach when you're trying to bring two parties to a solution or to a resolution is to reach a point where neither one of them is 100% happy with the outcome, but they're all willing to settle. That's what the legislative process is about. You know, to bring a majority together that will agree to the outcome even though they're not 100% happy. But, you know, you can eliminate both conflict and compromise from the process. If you eliminate conflict,
That's what I get for asking a politician to go first. You
know, who is also a country preacher.
Yeah, the OJ becomes.
But, you know, to... You know, you can eliminate it, but it will not be a democracy any longer. Okay? That's it.
You'll be able to talk more.
No doubt.
Okay, I'm Dorothy Sumoa, and I believe that because I became engaged in some of these conversations, I came up here because as a first-time villager, I kind of expected to kind of hover in the background, but that really doesn't happen too long with me anymore. But I've been in education for many, many years, starting out teaching English. I've served on a school board. I've also served in a state agency, and I've served in higher education. And in higher education, I'm in an administrative responsibility. But the ideas that I share, I think, come from a lot of the background from teaching prospective school administrators how to work within the public arena. And dealing with conflict is something that we talk about all the time. Over the years that I've been involved in education, I've seen some real significant changes in the way business is conducted, whether it's on a local level or beyond. Before, school district politics used to be very, very local. It was the school board that had the responsibility to make almost all the decisions, and they often didn't even have to consult with the community that they served. You were elected to the school board. School board meetings were typically not even very open in terms of having public participation or public view. And over the years, some laws became enacted whereby you had to have all of your meetings involve the public, and even if you had committee meetings, they could not be private. And even now, school board members and school administrators, if they're going to decide an issue before the public gets there, for example, by emailing, by serial telephone calls, these kinds of things, these are now illegal. So school district business has become open to the public eye, as city council meetings, as also county meetings, and of course the state legislature. But when this openness has happened, in addition, the politics has become more what the school district used to decide, the state is now deciding. What the state used to decide is now a federal politics. And so large school districts will have people representing them in the federal government, and they'll be also having people representing them in the state legislatures. And so what we used to settle among ourselves in our own communities has been pushed higher and higher. So then now what we're dealing with is a national agenda, for example, in education, No Child Left Behind. Most of us think that most of us in education see this as a serious intrusion on local decision making and having the local educators and parents and teachers decide what is best and what is right for their students. So then, given that we have this kind of an arena to make our decisions, some of the things that we try to teach are tools in terms of saying, how do you begin to look at whose interests are served? Politics would be the activity of deciding who gets what, why, and how. In looking at this from the level of conflict, you try to break this down in terms of saying, are you talking about values? For example, in school districts, some of the values are what should be taught in a school district. Evolution in some areas, of course, historically has been an issue, but can you teach Harry Potter? So how are you going to decide whether or not it is an appropriate thing to bring all the kids as a reward to see a Harry Potter movie? And this is to try to decide, okay, what are your rules for engagement here? And if you don't want your children to go to Harry Potter, you can have some alternate activity. Are you going to have the minority, for example, in talk radio, say that what the school districts are doing is evil and wrong? Or are you going to have a way of mediating this? And in my perspective, I think you try to decide how you're going to be fair to the majority and fair to the minority. How are you going to have a forum where everyone can be engaged and decide, are you talking about values or scarce resources or turf? So sometimes in terms of helping people to decide what it is that they're deciding, what is the big issue. Another way of looking at this is to try to help people, when they come together, to try to just make a list of who is involved and to what extent and what are their interests. And a lot of times in small groups, you can try to identify who you should be bringing to the table. You're looking at political parties, you're looking at citizens groups, you're looking at business groups, you're looking at church groups, you're trying to identify cultural minorities and other people who are there, who should be brought to the table. Then once you've decided who is a part of this and what their interests are, sometimes you decide that if you can come up with the issues that you all agree on, then you come up with strategies. For example, Fist to Five. Fist, I oppose this under all circumstances. I won't work with this, whereas five, I'm in complete agreement with this and I will lead it. And then you kind of lead groups through processes where you can maybe come up with a couple of things where you've all agreed that we can agree. Or sometimes you work through coalitions and you find all the leaders of the various groups and you say, of all the things that we disagree about, can we find two or three things we can agree about, and then go to the legislature and tell you, hey, all of us out here agree on this, please help us. Or interest-based bargaining. And then you come up with what your interests are and how you're going to be willing to compromise or give and take. So in the arenas that I've worked, we've tried to just work on what are the tools, the size of the group, the interests, and the scope of this. And so these are some of the just terms for ways of trying to break apart either groups of people who have all these diverse interests or strategies once you get people together to find ways to break down the topic so that you can talk about them sensibly. So that's where I come from.
Okay, thanks, Dorothy. Didn't have to put my...
I was watching you put my eyes. I'm starting to move a little.
My name is David Ranheim. I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota, a first-time Holden visitor. Lutheran by background, targeted to go to St. Olaf, as my whole family did, but I broke tradition and went to McAllister College, where I had the good fortune of running into a mentor, political science professor, much like John Moeller here, I think, whose sessions I've really enjoyed this week, who got a hold of me and said, what are you going to do with your life? And I said, well, I sort of thought I'd maybe be an accountant or something in business. He said, no, you don't want to do that. He said, you want to go to law school and be with the big boys. So I said, all right. I was a small town Minnesota kid. I didn't know any better. I listened to him. It was Ted Mitau. Some of you in the room may know that name. Anyway, I then went off to NYU Law School. I had never been in New York City before, and I landed in the middle of Greenwich Village back in the mid-60s, so that was quite a a small-town Lutheran kid who went to McAllister, and as Mitau told me, I arrived at McAllister with corn sticking out of my ears from southern Minnesota. He sent me off to the big city and polished me off to become a big-time lawyer. So anyway, that's a little bit of my background. From there, it's pretty simple. I came back to Minneapolis directly out of law school, joined the Dorsey & Whitney law firm, which was then the biggest law firm in the Midwest, I think, and still is. It's grown by about tenfold since I joined the firm. And for 35 years, I did commercial civil litigation as a trial lawyer. I just retired a couple of years ago, and I've had a variety of interesting things since in the nonprofit board world and have enjoyed that. But for 35 years, I was in the trenches, as they say. Challenging, interesting, exciting work. Compromise, it's not just for wimps. I want to advance the following thesis, that lawyers and the legal profession in general are living proof of the title of this forum. And I want to further advance the thesis that one way, there are multiple ways and all of you will have many ideas, one way to further get back to that road of compromise rather than the divisiveness that we see today is to elect more lawyers to legislative appoint more lawyers to executive positions, elect more lawyers to gubernatorial positions, and the like. Of course, judges, the judicial branch, the third branch, already have made up a lawyer. They have to be a lawyer to be a judge. But I want to defend the thesis as follows. When you think about what the general public thinks lawyers do, it sort of broadens into two categories. You have lawyers that fight, they litigate, like I did. They're in court fighting about either business disputes, divorces, criminal matters, all kinds of real property disputes, you name it, it's fighting. And that's what you see typically on television. Everybody's fighting. You also see in a more global sense from the business world, lots of lawyers fighting about business deals, the transactional side of the law, putting deals together, business transactions, and so forth. So if you sort of look at the law as these two big areas, and I'm really overgeneralizing, but look at it in those two big areas. What do you think about? Lawyers are advocates. They are hired by their clients to zealously represent their client, whether it's in a business deal or in court. So what do? You become an advocate. You zealously argue your client's position, whether it's across the table from another business opponent or whether it's across the table in a courtroom from an opponent there. So people think lawyers are always just fighting. They're always got their own interests in mind. They're just fighting. But not many people realize that ultimately, take first the business lawyers, the transactional lawyers, they must reach a business deal. And just as Gary alluded to in the legislature, you have to come to some kind of a compromise. No one gets everything that they want in the business deal. You both realize that you have to give something to get something, and you walk away with a deal. Nobody's completely happy, but you have a deal that you can live with. Look at the courtroom side, where lawyers are fighting over things. The reality is, again, a statistic that I think a lot of people don't realize, about 9 out of 10 cases are settled. They never get to a jury or to a judge for decision. What does that mean? It means that along the way, sometimes literally on the courthouse steps, sometimes literally after you've started picking a jury, sometimes halfway through the case, you settle the case. Why do you do that? Because you're risking losing everything. You may be betting the farm if you go all the way. So you reach a compromise. And you do that by saying, okay, what can my client afford to give up? And what are my bedrock things that I can't give up? And you make that decision, you talk with your client. Sometimes you have to persuade your client. Sometimes really beat your client up almost and say, look, if we go to court, you realize you're going to lose such and such. I can tell you based on the facts and the law, my best advice is you better settle. And sometimes you really have to tell your client to get real. Anyway, you finally come to a compromise, you get the case settled, and as Gary again said, nobody's 100% happy. That's the nature of the legal world. But you both go home, you save your money on lawyer's fees, you can forget about fighting, you can go on to new things, and you relieve your mind of all of the problems. So that's the reality of lawyers and the world they deal in. Lawyers are experts at compromise. That's what we do, day in and day out, in spite of what it may seem like out in the public. And so that's the nature of the legal profession. Just to cap this, I guess, I would suggest that also in the legal world, there's a lot more attention paid now to what's called ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution. A lot less courtroom fighting to resolve disputes, and a lot more mediation, arbitration, other kinds of things that are more expeditious, cheaper, and people realize again, at the end of the day, we need to come to some middle ground, otherwise the judge or a jury or an arbitrator is going to tell us you're going to have to do such and such. And then it's sort of an all or nothing proposition. I would simply offer this in closing. Is it any coincidence, do you think? And this comes back to the point that raised the laughter earlier. Is it any coincidence that though lawyers, people think lawyers dominate the public arena? The reality, I think, is otherwise. I think the statistics show that there are fewer lawyers now in state legislatures, in Congress, and in the executive branch of both states and federal government. There are fewer lawyers today than there used to be. And at the same time, the divisiveness and the inability to compromise and the polarization has gone up. Numbers of lawyers going down, polarization going up. I rest my case.
A little later, I can offer an opposing argument.
You don't have to. You did a good job opposing it. Right?
Go ahead, John.
My name is John Moeller, and I teach political science at Luther College. I've been here this week on the teaching staff. So I was actually going to pass because plenty of people here have heard enough of my ideas about these things. But I will make one comment that as I listened to the three previous people, just throw out one idea on all this. It's interesting, here you have three professionals, and I mean professionals who are representing the public in official capacities, all very much committed to the idea of compromise, the ability to look for some kind of common ground, some common good, and so forth. Which leads me to wonder if maybe part of the problem we have in America today is, and I know this will sound awful to many of you, is hyper-democracy. That maybe where we have gone wrong, and I think this is probably something that began to develop politically with the decline of political parties and things really growing out of 1968 Democratic Convention, and putting all these things more in the hands of individuals, the individual citizen, such that a Jimmy Carter, for example, could have no real support in the party, but could go directly to the people, And ultimately now, this has developed that political candidates don't have to really appeal to parties at all. They can simply have a lot of money and campaign directly. We have lots of referendums. And it may be that actually there is an art to the ability to compromise and to make these kinds of judgments that comes with practice, that comes with skill, that comes with people who are well-practiced in this sort of thing. And maybe we, the citizenry, are not especially good at making those decisions themselves, but what we are capable of doing is electing representatives or choosing individuals to make these kinds of judgments for us. Remember, ours was not a pure democracy, and those of you who have ever read James Madison defending the Constitution and the famous Federalist Number 10 makes it clear that every pure democracy in the past had failed. In fact, this was the great, one of the greatest theoretical documents, I think, in thinking about democratic politics in the world, seriously. And Madison turned the idea on its head. Up to this point in time, everyone had said you have to have small democracies so the people can all be involved. And Madison said, no, those have all failed. In this new order for the ages, this new experiment, what we're going to do is have an extended republic, a system whereby we choose representatives who are skilled in these kinds of things, and they can essentially, they go to the deliberative bodies and they translate the private interest that we have. Madison knew we weren't all going to look at the world the same. And what they do is when they come together, they translate this into some kind of a public good. Because this is what they do well. And it's one of the reasons for not having term limits. Because people get better and better at this over a period of time. So I would just throw out that one, and this, you know, there's a million things at stake here. So this is just one idea you might play with, that maybe our problem is not that we're not democratic enough, but maybe that we've had too much democracy. And so in the old days where a school board could sit down and make some judgments, now everybody in town's got to have their say. In the old days where a zoning commission could sit through and think about this and say, this is the way to go. Now everyone's got to have their say. And this is exactly what happens at colleges as well. I suspect in the old days administrators would make judgments. And now the faculty, they all know how to do it right. And so we're going to tell every administrator, oh, you're doing it wrong. And so maybe what we need to do in some ways is get back to our roots and have some confidence in representatives who really are skilled at compromise and listening to each other and looking for some common good. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay, I'm going to silence these folks up here for a while and give everyone else a chance, unless you specifically want them to speak to something. But go ahead.
I have a question. When do you think this divisiveness noticeably took place, and more importantly, why did it take place? One writer said then-Senator Dole and Bill Clinton, if you put them in a room together, they always come out with a compromise. And those are two great leaders that could come up with a compromise. But my question is, why did this come about? As you see it.
Anybody else want to speak to that question or have thoughts on it? Any ideas? Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's a major factor, but I think there's really a polarization in the. I'm sure it's on the far left, but particularly now on the far right, they're the ones that have all the radio time. And if you've ever listened to Rush Limbaugh, or any other ticket, they don't give an inch. Have you ever heard them savage somebody who calls in and says, well, I wonder if you are wrong in this, Mr. Limbaugh? And it's just the most uncivil thing I've ever heard. Now, I'm saying it could probably happen on the far left, you know, somebody like that to it. So I'm just saying there's a lot of, he calls them diddle heads, I guess, you know, people who agree with him completely. There's no agreeing with 80%. I mean, it's all there. And so you're taking a lot of the middle is left, but it's a lot less middle. Maybe, like I say, I don't think that's a major factor, but I think it's something that might contribute.
Anybody want to speak to the time, then his question up here?
Well, I'd go back to what I suggested a moment. I really do think a lot of this began to develop in the 1960s with the ideological politics that begin to take place. And I seriously believe the breakdown of political parties has contributed dramatically, because political parties
used to be concerned with only one thing, winning elections. And they won elections by screening out candidates who could appeal to a broad array of people. And there was a real interest in looking for sort of middle ground candidates. That's the reason you could have a Southern, you know, Democratic Party working with the Northeastern Democrats, and they would have a coalition. I think a lot of that began to break down with a sort of an ideological politics in the 60s that has developed. And then the right got especially better at this, actually, because of think tanks and so forth than the left was, I think, at one point. And that's my really simplistic overview of some of the things that took place.
Yeah.
You know, we tend to forget the extent to which the Vietnam War polarized this country. And I think the views that were prevalent on the two sides in the Vietnam War have continued to be the predominant views. The people have kind of gravitated towards one or the other. And I think that's a polarization that started then and we still live with it. We still have it.
Yes. My concern, especially looking at the future, is, you know, kids that we've raised with entitlement as well as with apathy, I mean, the future is not looking very good for politics. And any comment on the fact that, you know, are we getting, you know, kids involved and, you know, some of the concerns with, you know, again, talk about in your face, you know, they're in your face for grades, they're in your face for, you know, this is what I deserve, you know. I've worked.
You're on a college campus. Well, just a comment. I guess I think there's kind of a renaissance of interest on college campuses. I don't know if that's true at Lutheran. But I guess I see more interest in younger people today in the political arena than I have in any of the 8 years that I've been in office. You know, coming back to the other question, I think there are different segments of our society that do promote the no compromise approach to the political arena, and there are even some churches that I think do that, and it's not very helpful. It's a different arena.
Go ahead.
As a retired school superintendent, I've been through all the labor contract issues. Those are usually compromise things, but like in Iowa, the ultimate is binding arbitration. I mean, there's no strike is not allowed, and you get to binding arbitration, the contract has to be one side or the other. There's no compromising. I've had experience one time with the board. They were just, you know, they didn't want to compromise with anybody. They just said, we'll go to binding arbitration, let some outsider decide it, and the public can blame them for it, you know, and advise them that you're going to lose it. It's just the way things are going to be, and they lost it. They didn't care. Just didn't care. Let somebody else decide it for them. But didn't want to compromise. And I think we see a lot of groups, small, or school boards, cities, maybe legislatures, just compromise. It's not, you know, we have a certain principle or certain beliefs. We're just not going to vote.
Yeah.
I wonder if any of you would address the subject of religion as impacting this division and this refusal to compromise on things.
You want to say more about that?
Yes, well, I mean, I'm thinking about certain issues, like recently the Catholic Church denying communion to people who are not pro-life, and other things like that. I mean, just the mentality that some Christians have about, you know, you do this and this and this and you're going to heaven and everybody else goes to hell. And it's a really black and white picture sometimes, I feel like. And I wonder if that adds to our not being willing to compromise.
So is it a contributor or is it just a reflection of it in another place?
I'm neither a politician nor a theologian, but as an outsider looking in, I share what I sense is a concern. Because I do think that in many respects, the religious right in particular, again, trying to be neutral here, but the religious right in particular, I think, has polarized it to try to make it black and white. And I think one of the huge challenges we face as a society is to somehow educate a broader segment of the populace that things aren't that black and white, and that even when it comes to religion, somehow there needs to be some give and take once it enters into the public arena. And we can't have, for example, I'll just throw out an example that is very much closer to Gary's area than mine, but in Minnesota, I'm convinced, and Gary can comment on this, but we have not had a special session of the legislature called, even though we badly need one, for a bonding bill, a budget, and the key fiscal things that a government is clearly responsible for. And as I understand it, one of the big reasons we can't get the governor to call a special session is because if he calls it, then either he or the Speaker of the House is going to insist that there be a consideration of a constitutional amendment on the same-sex marriage issue. So here's a perfect example of a social issue taken up by what I think is the religious right. You don't have to be religious right to take a certain position on that, but to me, that has stymied the legislative process from doing its real work because of a particularly narrow interest group that is coming forward and basically hijacking the process. And I don't know how we get beyond that other than to educate a broader segment of the population that we need government to do more than to focus on single social issues.
There was a piece in a recent issue of the Christian Century magazine that was pointing out that not too long ago, the division lines in politics were generally aligned between labor and business. Now the division lines in politics are aligned within religion. That's the driver now for political decisions that are being made these days.
Kyle?
One
over there. He's had his hand up three times.
Okay, well, I'm real concerned about your situation where the federal government, we used to make a local decision, and now it's worked its way up where you're under some federal regulation for a community decision, and then the federal guys hang all this stuff up forever or manipulate, and it suddenly becomes a monoculture anyway, nationally, of decision making, where you can't make your own unique efforts out in your school district. And that's my biggest.
Standardized.
Yeah,
and it's the federal government is dictating the standard for it.
And how can creativity exist, and how can compromise exist when they're dictating these things to become a standard policy?
Well, there's no recognition that there's wide variation among states in how their schools operate.
Right. So how can you have the birth of a new and successful thing that people can copy? Because it's all becoming one. That's all I can do.
Well, we probably sold our souls to the fact that the federal government will give some money, but never enough for the program that they mandate. Mm-hmm. And so then as a result, there are very few states, there are very few states or school districts that have the courage to say, we're going to turn down this money and we're going to do it our way, because we're not going to be beholden to a set of mandates that don't even apply to the situation we have.
There have been some.
Right, some have.
Okay. A perfect example of that is the federal mandate for special education that the federal government said they were going to fund at 40%. In Minnesota, they have never funded it at more than 17%, and last year it was 13% statewide. It varies from district to district. So, you know, it's far short of what they had promised.
Did you want to comment on the religious question?
Well, I think, you know, getting back to Elsa's question, I do think that there, you know, that perception is certainly accurate. I think, you know, there are whole denominations that ask you not to compromise. I think, you know, to compromise on your own beliefs as an individual is quite different from making compromise in the public policy arena. I guess I would go so far as to, you know, and they're promoting it as the Christian position, as though there can be no other Christian position. You know, I personally believe that there are no such things in the public policy arena as Christian positions. There are simply Christians who hold positions for different reasons, for their own understanding of the life of faith. You know, I mean, there are things in my life that I won't vote on. I mean, I had a guy that, you know, I just, first off, Minnesota, you know, on the same-sex issue, Minnesota has a law that bans same-sex marriages, and we have a Supreme Court decision that defines marriage as being between a man and a woman. So why do we need it on the Constitution? You know, and I just, I had one guy who was so angry with me, told me he was gonna work hard against me in the next campaign, and I didn't think he'd make a very good candidate, so I told him how to file. But, I mean, this guy said, well, you're a pastor, you know, why won't you support this? And I finally told him, I said, well, because wherever I go, I have to live with me. And I have to live with my understanding of what my faith in God means and how that relates to other people. And so I can't vote for that, you know, and I don't have to live with you.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking about the role of religion in our larger society, and it's kind of interesting that some religious groupings have kind of rallied around that sense of no compromise, that it's a sellout. If you look at religious tradition, Jewish and Christian historically, there is that sense of give and take. The word for actually business in Hebrew is literally give and take. And if you take a look at that, and it's a biblical phrase, in terms of how does a society get what it needs and give what, you know, needs to be given. And in some ways, that sense, I'm not sure where it entered in, that compromise was a negative thing, especially within social structures. One other point in terms of how religion has played a role in American politics, I've been reading a little bit about American politics after and during World War I and the way that religion was brought in to support the war and the military. There were actually posters with Jesus in a commando suit holding a gun to advertise to recruit for military and to support the war. I mean, this is an interesting time in our history, so we tend to think this is the first time that we see religion emerging in it. It has always been there. It's taken different forms. Today, we haven't seen Jesus in a commando suit going into Iraq on posters, thank goodness. But we've seen other things that aren't so far from it.
Only our president.
Yeah. Well.
Go ahead, John. I'll show my colors here, that sometimes I feel like a Holden Village outsider. I think we're really quick to blame the religious right, and I'm not part of the religious right, but I think we're very quick to blame the religious right for being unwilling to compromise. And, you know, we all have seen the light. We're very enlightened about these things, but darn that religious right. They just can't see it our way, and so they therefore are so rigid. In Missouri, I think the constitutional amendment, at least the paper that someone gave me that from the Seattle paper, that wasn't the final results, but I think that constitutional amendment was passing somewhere in the range of 60-70%. Now, I don't think the religious right in America consists of 70%, and if it is, then it's not just some really insignificant group, you know, we're talking about 70% of the people of the state of Missouri. We're not talking about some hardcore group that's keeping everything from compromising. And so it seems to me, and I mean, I see this all the time in academia, I'll confess, it bothers me a lot, that there's a kind of attitude by a lot of people who are convinced that same-sex marriage is the right thing, and I'm not saying it's not the right thing, but just can't understand why anybody else might not see it that way. And oftentimes, those advocates of same-sex marriage are in your face, and they're saying, we're not going to settle for a compromise with civil unions at this point in time. We're going to have same-sex marriage tomorrow or nothing else. And so I think it's important. And this is what I spend my life doing, trying to get students to look at both sides of the issues and not be so doggone certain that they're right. Well, I'm sorry if I sound like a sermon. But so I hope that all of you who are committed to same-sex marriage will also understand that there are other people out there who are good, decent people who are struggling with this issue. And that sometimes the inability to compromise comes from both sides. People who are sure that they've seen the truth on this one. And so, and again, I'm not going to sit here and defend the religious right who are not willing to compromise, because I absolutely agree that that exists out there. But I also think there are a lot of people on the left committed to social justice who are pretty sure what the truth is, and anyone who can't see that yet just hasn't become progressive enough or has not been enlightened enough. And so now I've had my say after a week at Holden Village, which I found highly enjoyable. But oftentimes I've felt that, man, you know, I'm not just liberal enough, and I don't really fit here, do I? Because I think some of these questions are more open-ended than all the people I'm sitting around. They've seen it, and boy, I wish I'd seen the light as well. So I apologize if that's offensive, but I actually had to get that out after a very exciting week at Holden Village.
So, boys, go ahead, Greg. He's
Elsa brings up the point about the church and how the church is affecting politics. I'm wondering about the politics within the church. Our Senate assemblies, I think, have gone from being conventions to being assemblies. And we've gone from having delegates to having voting members. And I think that picks up on what John was talking about, saying that the representatives who go to the assembly are not taking a straw vote of everyone in their congregation and then representing that at the assembly. They're being lifted up as leaders and sent to the assembly and saying, you go figure this out and listen to everyone else and vote and let us know what happens. In our congregations, though, it seems like we have hyper-democracy because we have a council making decisions. But at least in the churches that I've been part of, everything has to get voted on by the entire congregation. So I just wonder, how does what you're talking about translate back into a church nationally and congregationally?
I just want to get back to what John was saying and clarify a little bit. And I happen to be married to Gary, so I get quite inside view of this, but I think you're assuming that Gary is in favor of same-sex marriage.
I'm not even talking about, I don't even know Gary's position, so I'm not talking about Gary.
Well, okay, but let me just say this, and I don't want same-sex marriage to be the focus of this discussion, but it is a very polarizing thing, and I can just say that Gary and I are not in a position of supporting same-sex marriage, but we cannot support people that carry around signs that say execute homosexuals, and homosexuals are doomed to hell. And that's what we're seeing from the religious right. And so, yes, we are being judgmental on a group, on the extreme end of a group that is really polarizing people, working very hard to polarize people, and I think trying to rile people up, and I would say that if in Missouri 70% have voted for that amendment, they have been given a lot of misinformation, and fear is playing a big role in what's going on there.
That really gets back to a fundamental point, I think, about the art of representative democracy and one of John's comments the other day about, do we want the Burkean model where you actually elect somebody to use their judgment, or do you elect them simply to count up the ballots in their district and go and sort of put in a ballot? And it seems to me that if you're going to make this system work and to ever get to a compromise position, you have to do more than just count up the majority. Because the majority, even the 70% in Missouri, may not be thinking in an overall policy sense about what's more appropriate. And so you need to have some judgment exercised by the people that are in the legislature to try to make it a broader perspective on things, whether it's from the left or from the right. I mean, again, be neutral about this, whether it's left or right, everybody has to recognize that you need to compromise. The left isn't going to get all it wants, the right's not going to get all it wants. So why do we fight and spend countless dollars, time, energy, and so forth to come up with no solutions, like our state legislature this year was virtually unproductive, sorry, Gary. It did almost nothing that I count as true governmental action because it was hamstrung by these issues. Why couldn't you get the left and the right, even on this issue of same-sex marriage, to come together and say, look, we need to take this issue off the table for the reasons Gary mentioned. We already have a law and we have a Supreme Court decision. Why do we need, basically for political purposes of the people up for election this fall, who can say, I voted for a constitutional amendment, and they know it's not going to pass, they know that that's not in the cards, and yet they're hijacking the political process. So it seems to me that, the religious left, the religious right, they all need to say, look, what is our true mission here as a government of the people?
You had a hand up here.
Well, yeah, and I guess as the conversation proceeded, I mean, I probably grew up in a fairly democratic family, very, very staunch Republican, so over the years, you know, I've kind of tried to understand what are the good things about Democrats and what are the good things about Republicans, and to go off of John's comment and some of my experiences here this week, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges for Holden as a community, and I think the session is exactly getting at the heart of it, is trying to keep thoughts and minds open to what I call the middle ground, the group of, I guess I want to believe people in America in general want the best for themselves and others, and that is somewhere in the middle. It gets kind of at some of John's sessions today about, you know, things aren't black and white. My mother listens to Rush Limbaugh all the time, and I'm forced to listen because I'm in the car. my advice to him, sometimes I agree with what he says, but sometimes I say to my husband, the biggest challenge in listening to his program is to think about what is absolutely right, or what is just, you know, you have to challenge your own mind on that. And it seems, and there may be media programs out there that would cater to that middle ground, but that's, you know, that's not as clear. That's not black and white, but it would be showing some of the grayness and trying to bring people to some conclusion, or as the session is, compromise, because that's where it's at.
I've worked on different church constitutions, and it's interesting to go back that the ones written in the 19th century and those in the 20th century were based upon a theocracy model in the past, and there's a difficulty to deal with church politics in a democracy. And for instance, in our synod, the last bishop was elected totally by both Republican and Democratic candidate delegates united, because the leaders on both parties brought their people to a compromise. And so it was every delegate to the political convention that was at the Senate convention got together from two parties.
Oh, I didn't know that happened. Was there somebody else who hadn't spoken?
Well, I was just going to make a brief comment when you said about the majority and going back to them about Madisonian ethics and protecting the minority as the main role of government. That was all I had to say.
Two of the panelists alluded to too much democracy. That was your opening comment. My cousin in Princeton, and I'm suggesting this probably could be true of any community like Princeton, on local issues, and there, such as environment, for example. If people are so well educated, and there are so many lawyers and so much money, that they just deadlock almost every issue in the community, which supports what you were both implying, that perhaps we have swung to so much activism that we become deadlocked. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that any others here from any of this other type of community have experienced the same thing.
Well, let me just ask back, though. I gather it's a very highly educated community, obviously. Yes. Didn't you find, though, or wouldn't you, I would expect you would find, that in a highly educated community, yes, you have passionate views, but they also are educated enough and savvy enough to realize that you do need to come to a middle ground. Whereas maybe the less savvy, the less educated community may say, it is more black and white. We see it in black and white.
You got way too much confidence in education.
Wisdom and
degrees aren't the same thing.
That's a degree you're supposed to do.
And yeah.
Okay. I was going to speak a long time ago, but I just held up. It seems to me that a person needs to also make, we talk about spiritual awakening, you need to have a political awakening. When I keep kidding, I was born a Lutheran and baptized a Republican. And when I was a, became a university pastor, well, I began to see I need to think differently. And so I said, where can I get involved, and where can I raise some questions? It was during the McCarthy period, not Joe, but Eugene, and also during the Vietnam period. And I worked with the students and protest groups, and I kept saying, we need to respect those who disagree with us, because that's what our system is. And we obey the law. We have plenty of space. But also that we need to adjust our thinking. And I learned also in the process, I put quite a bit of time in the political process. And if you're willing to work in it, you can make a tremendous impact, especially on the county and the state legislature. Because not many people do much at all. You find that a dozen people working hard in the community can change the political climate. They're willing to work, spend some time. And you don't have to be brilliant, you don't have to be anything else, just be somebody. And most of us don't do anything. All we do is read the paper and editorials and then express our opinions. But and then write to your congressman or your Senate legislators and tell them. Someone said, I had a lot of letters in this. How many? I got six in this issue.
I'll paraphrase another holder of public office. A dozen letters on anything is a landslide.
Interesting. Yeah.
I'll comment on the apparent rise in power of special interest groups in influencing and electing our political leaders.
I want to be conscious of our time, too, and just make sure that if there wasn't anybody out here who had some comment to make, maybe not a question, but an additional comment. Yeah.
Yeah, as I've been listening to the discussion, I think the societal difficulty in perhaps making compromise can, for me, be very personalized in that if I have difficulty inside myself, perhaps because of a lack of a spirituality or perhaps not really taking the time to get to know who I am and compromise, if you will, with myself and understand why I have these conflicts, it's going to be much more difficult for me to come to compromise with my family members. It may be more difficult for me to come to compromise with my coworkers. And as you keep looking at that, as I keep looking at that, and I see the bigger and bigger picture, what this whole idea of lack of compromise in our society, between nations or whatever, a lot of times can really stem back to the individual, where that development is as an individual, and how that individual compromises and talks to one's self about all the conflicts that are going on, that perhaps could be going on within oneself. Mm-hmm. And
good point.
That's, I think, another way of looking at it. The microcosm can be, or maybe it's the macrocosm, the big picture can be a reflection of the smaller picture of the development of oneself.
Thank you. I want to get back then to his
100%.
His question that he posed to the panel.
Just a suggestion, maybe if the panel could respond. Gary, is that your name?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking you to do. Yeah.
That could conclude the...
Yes.
Well, could you restate the question quickly?
I wanted you to comment on the apparent rise in power of special interest groups in electing and influencing political leaders.
Well, again, from my perspective, I think special interest groups arise because there are people in our society at large who wish to have an impact on legislation that they will benefit from. And so, special interest groups are not disconnected from our society. They are part and parcel of it. I guess I tend not to take money from groups that I just disagree with. Some of them, well, you get a lot of questionnaires. Everybody wants you to fill out the questionnaire. You could spend 2 weeks filling out a questionnaire for every group that you got. And, you know, you don't have time for all of that, really, but you do as much as you can, I suppose, because it's a way of educating the public. But I don't take a lot of special interest money, but I do take some. There are elected officials who don't take special interest money at all on the state level. But I suppose you could say that the special interest groups from whom I do take money, you could say, just looking at my voting record, well, you know, they've influenced him. When the reality is the other way around, I don't take money from those with whom I disagree. If I just am diametrically opposed to where they're coming from. I don't know. I think it varies a lot at one level of government or the other. I would say the federal level of government, you have to have so much money and it's so laden with it. Minnesota has limits on the amount that you can spend. And if you choose not to abide by those limits, then you are not eligible to receive public dollars that support your campaign. And I think the whole political process ought to be funded with public dollars to remove that.
Yeah, sure. Brief comments, and then we'll wrap it up.
To that point, I think that your point is a very valid one. Special interest groups seem to have a larger and larger presence. Lobbyists have a larger and larger presence, hired by the special interest groups. Tons of money being poured into this. And I think that all has contributed to what I see, and if John could comment on this from a broader perspective. As an outsider, I see that as sort of destroying a sense, even in our elected officials, of a common weal, of a common good, that we must be here to serve a common good, whether we're in the executive branch or the legislative branch, that we've sort of lost the sense that somehow there's a broader good that sort of sorts out and serves everybody. And so that a rural legislator has to keep in mind that a suburban or a city legislator also has interests. And they're not all going to get everything that they want, but they all need to keep in mind the common good. And I think that the special interest groups, all of that has led to a much more of a sense that, well, we don't really have a common good to worry about. All we have to worry about is the special interests that have got our ear, and in some cases, maybe our pocketbook. And I don't know how we get beyond that, but I think that's a fundamental sort of breakdown in what I at least used to see as being fairly present in the legislative process, and that was a sense that we're all in this together and we need to make some trade-offs here and some compromises.
Well, and the best antidote to that are the very things that Dorothy was talking about. I've seen several instances where grassroots people who are organized will defeat a special interest group that is very well known.
And I think another thing, too, from the time I've been involved with the political parties quite a number of years ago to now, people coming into the political parties now seem to be coming in representing special interest groups. And so I think that the people have to reclaim the political parties and not just let this special interest group that get this delegate spot and on down the line. Because political parties used to debate a whole range of public policy issues. And now you have people coming in with firm stands on one or two positions and not the ability to debate the large range of issues that affect all the people. So I think we as citizens have allowed this to happen to our political parties, and I think this is what has hurt the whole process.
I'm going to bring it to a formal close. That's my job, but please feel free to continue the conversation. And I thank everybody for their comments and the many voices we got to hear from, and that's always a good thing. So thanks to our panelists and for all of you for coming.